receive an eviction notice, it'd be good to contact one of these organizations to get legal help, because it's very complicated to handle it on your own without the help of an attorney. There's a lot of nonprofits that do excellent work. Some of them will help you just filling out the forms to respond to any complaint, or some of them will actually go and represent you full representation in court. There are some attorneys in private practice that do pro bono. A lot of the bulk of this work is being done by nonprofit organizations where the attorneys do get paid for their nonprofit and who get funded by grants or otherwise. And then it's free in many instances to the individual, to the client. But there are many ways of going. So I think it is possible to get help without having to pay a lot of money.
On that note, Attorney Gilbert Salcedo, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you, John.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission.
Looking for another way to support KPFK? By donating your vehicle, you're supporting the programming you value. Donating your vehicle is quick and easy. You can always pledge your support at kpfk.org. You appreciate KPFK, and we appreciate you.
This we're fighting for is KPFK. We shall not be moved. 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Freedom, we shall not.
Hello and welcome to Radio Antifada, a weekly review of politics and culture from Kolkata to Casablanca here on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in Northern San Diego, and streaming worldwide on kpfk.org. My name is Ankine Antaram, and I'm a member of the South Asia, West Asia, and Northern Africa, or the SWANA Collective that produces this show. My co-host today is fellow collective member Misha Chowdhury. We'd like to thank our sister show Middle East in Focus for lending us their half hour of airtime this week. In this hour, we will discuss the impact of ICE arrests in Los Angeles, SWANA communities, and then we want to hear from you, our listeners. We will open the lines, so please be ready to call in and share your thoughts on our discussion. Misha? I apologize. Actually, Misha, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, Misha. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, after being sworn in as U.S. President in January 2025, Donald Trump's expansion and escalation of an already inhumane U.S. immigration system has further endangered the lives of millions of people. These escalations include pausing the approved resettlement of tens of thousands of refugees, plans to reject refugee status for hundreds of thousands of people, and suspend work permits for asylum seekers, ending humanitarian parole for immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, leaving over 500,000 people here in legal limbo, and resuming and expanding the Remain in Mexico policy, forcing asylum seekers to wait outside the U.S. while their claims are processed and while the southern border is largely closed to new arrivals. Misha.
This past Friday, Trump's big, beautiful bill, a mega bill with $170 million for border and immigration enforcement, was approved by Congress. To achieve its goal of 1 million annual deportations, Trump has promised to expand efforts to detain and deport people in some of the nation's largest cities, such as Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. Today, we focus on the impact of and resistance to these raids in Los Angeles, particularly on SWANA communities. Joining us today is our guest, Shimoni Basu. Thank you for being here, Shimoni.
Happy to be here.
Shimoni is a community and movement lawyer serving as the immigration attorney at South Asian Network. They are an immigrant with ancestral roots from India and Bangladesh. They have been in the immigration space for almost a decade, working in various aspects of the immigration legal system with a focus on crimmigration, the intersection of the criminal and immigration systems. She has been at the border and inside detention centers and has seen firsthand how dangerous, punitive, and racist our immigration systems are. Shimone is committed to fighting for and co-creating a future with no borders, no ICE, and where migration is seen as a beautiful and natural part of our history and ecology. Tell us a little bit more about the work you do. What communities and areas do you serve?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So in my current role at South Asian Network, I primarily serve South Asian communities, and that includes a variety of countries currently known as like India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, Afghanistan, Sri Lanka. I'm probably missing some, but those are our primary kind of like community members that we serve. But the organization and my work is definitely not limited to just people with these backgrounds. Just the other day, we had, you know, folks walking in from the Philippines and other parts of, with nationalities from other parts of Southeast Asia and across the world. So that is kind of our primary community that I serve and work with. But again, it really, we are here and I'm here for, I would say, the larger immigrant rights and immigrant communities.
That's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience visiting detention centers and how that shaped the way that you approach working with immigrant and migrant communities?
Yes, definitely. So I have primarily visited detention centers in the Southern California region. So the biggest one that is closest to us in Los Angeles is the Adelanto Detention Facility. It's about 2 hours away inland. And I have been there several times to meet with folks that are detained, to do interviews with them, to represent them, to do bond hearings to get them out. And I've done some advocacy in like coalitions on larger kind of like litigation and policy to ideally shut down the detention centers. We can talk a little bit more about this later, but Adelanto was actually like down to one person detained, and we were really close to it being closed, but now it's like pretty full in just the last like couple months. Which is really devastating. And then I've also done some work specifically at the Imperial Regional Detention Facility. That's what it's called. It's in Calexico. It's by the border. And that is even more remote. A lot of our detention facilities are intentionally remote and far from communities. So it is very isolating. It also brings up a conversation on local economies, because a lot of these towns, that is like the only source of people's jobs to work at the kind of facilities. So thinking about this recent bill passing and kind of larger policy, that's something to keep in mind. But yeah, coming back to kind of like the work I do, I would say I haven't even like my experience visiting detention centers has been limited. And even then, what I've seen has definitely like stayed with me. It's a prison. It's called a detention center, but it's prison. I have worked with folks who've been there for years, like many years, which is just, and a lot of those people were imprisoned in state prison before then. So they've just been incarcerated a lot of their adult lives. That's getting into some of my passions in crimmigration, the like prison to ICE prison pipeline. But yeah, for now, I'll say that it definitely impacts me. I think that especially in this moment where there's a lot of fear and panic and people are getting detained, I am thinking about like the reality of what that means and why we want to do everything we can to prevent that.
And we want to come back to the detention centers. But first, I want to
Read a quote from the chief executive of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Southern California Center, Connie Chung Jo. She said, "Our community is much more silenced, but we are being detained in really high numbers. There's such a stigma and fear that, unlike the Latinx community that wants to fight and speak out about the injustices, our community's first reaction is to go down and get more and more hidden." I'm wondering if you see this kind of fear in the communities you work with, and we are trained to think by media to associate deportations with Mexicans, Hispanic, and Latinx communities. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it definitely isn't accurate. It impacts definitely those communities, but it also impacts the communities that, you know, I serve, that we're here talking about on the show. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but on some recent list, South Asian countries made up the third or fourth most deported folks. Mm-hmm. So it definitely is not an insignificant population of both people recently arriving to the country and also being then in removal proceedings or deported. And yeah, I would love to speak a little bit to the community and the differences and how we might be showing up. I do think there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of internalized kind of shame in our communities, again, speaking for my work with the South Asian, Southeast Asian community, where it's seen as like a personal failure, or, you know, these ideals of like the minority myth are coming in, where it's like, you know, that doesn't apply to us, or, you know, we did it quote unquote the right way, but that's not the reality, you know, and that's not a personal failure. It's because the system is designed to exclude and punish people for seeking to migrate. And that impacts everyone, including Southeast Asian, South Asian communities, Swana communities. So yeah, that is both the reality, and I'm seeing firsthand the kind of stigma and shame that a lot of people are carrying. And it honestly is hard, because it means we get less information, we get less data. Mm-hmm. They're not reporting to us when things happen. So it's allowing the state's infrastructure to disappear people to operate even more strongly.
Wow, absolutely. So part of what we are seeing right now, it seems like there is this sense of unpredictability, mm-hmm. even for people who maybe do have like legal status, there just is this fear.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can speak to like how many people are at risk of being detained in this moment, and what is particular about this moment, and how is that shifting the way that we understand legal status?
Yeah, it definitely is a complicated question, because a lot of what is legal in our country is constructed and has not always been the case. So a lot of our immigration legal system is very new. The current system was basically, without getting into all the histories, adopted in 1996 and then post 9/11 in 2001. So we're talking about a pretty recently developed constructed system that are even like one generation ago didn't have the same rules. So with that said, it is unpredictable. I would say it is really hard, even for me being in the space, to be able to give any like estimate on numbers or percentage or who is at risk, because it's intentionally like creating an environment right now where everyone's at risk. And I think, of course, folks who don't have any status are undocumented are at the most risk. Of course, people who have, you know, certain criminal convictions are at higher risk. But I think part of what makes this moment particularly difficult, to put it simply, is that they are also utilizing what has always been on the books, again, always being relatively recent, to arrest, detain, and or try to, you know, remove legal status from a host of other folks. A lot of people who have their green cards are still at risk if they have certain criminal history or convictions, or if there's some issue in their past. A lot of people have, you know, legal status or a green card or even citizenship now, but they may have gone through a lot of hurdles to get that, or maybe were previously undocumented for some time. And those sorts of things are being kind of brought up and investigated at a new degree, I would say. And then, of course, anyone on like a visa has always been considered temporary and like can be revoked at any time because it's like the country is giving you quote unquote permission to be here. So even if someone has legal status through a visa, if that's just like taken away suddenly, then they've lost their legality. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lot of what's happening right now. They're expanding who falls into the categories of people that they want to detain or try to detain by stripping them of status some other way.
Mm.
So regarding the process, what happens when someone is detained? Are they allowed to get a lawyer and file a case? Are they immediately deported? What is the process there? And you said something about how they're choosing. Can you say a little more about how ICE is deciding whom to arrest?
Yes, I can speak to that last part first, because the answer is kind of I don't know. And I think at this particular moment, a lot of the unpredictability and vastness of raids, especially in the LA area, is intentionally unpredictable and is intentionally vast. And also, like, they have never been great about following warrants and identifying themselves, but right now they're really like not even trying. And as we've, you know, maybe all seen, like, mistakenly detaining people and picking up citizens and just profiling. So there's a lot of unpredictability that makes it hard to say, you know, what they're prioritizing. But typically what has been the case and what they claim to still be doing is people who are undocumented, who have certain criminal convictions, and which we can get into, because I think when people hear that, they think it's like extreme convictions. But I have worked with someone who lost their status and was deported for a fake check. So when we talk about criminal convictions, it's also like can be pretty broad. And lastly, I think they're also looking into like prior immigration fraud. So I would say those are the priorities that they claim. But again, on the ground sometimes right now is very unpredictable, it seems. And then to the kind of other half of the question with what happens when someone's detained, it really is an individualized thing. So it's hard to say. Some people, depending on how long they've been here, what status they had, what community ties they have, might be able to fight their case for longer. Whereas other people who are more recently arriving don't have maybe secure status, maybe have, you know, are just arriving and they're detained upon arrival. They might be more kind of like quickly put into deportation proceedings. So those are just like the general categories. It is going to depend on someone's individual case. Everyone is allowed to get a lawyer, but I think something that isn't always clear is that unlike our criminal system, people aren't given a lawyer. So while mm-hmm. you have the right to a lawyer, it's not guaranteed. So you still have to find your own lawyer. You have to, which again, if you're already detained, as I was saying earlier, those are often very isolated, remote areas that it's hard to get in touch with community and lawyers. And at the same time that they are creating kind of more of a need for lawyers, they're also defunding a lot of legal organizations that provide these services. So it's making it harder to have enough lawyers, or the few of us that are there might have, you know, more work than we can do. That's a little bit of kind of the landscape of what happens once someone's detained and what their case can look like.
So this kind of state violence, of course, it impacts everybody who is in the life of someone who has been detained. And there's been so much emphasis on families lately and preventing family separation that occurs through deportation and detainment. Can you talk a little bit more about, just in your experience, what have you seen families of people that are being detained, what they go through, and what kind of needs do they have, and how are they coping?
Yeah, I can speak to this a little bit. again, it's definitely a lot of fear and panic and sometimes shame. They are isolating themselves and maybe, you know, afraid to tell other people. Maybe there's other people in the family who also have, you know, insecure status. So then they're, you know, feeling more unsafe personally. But a lot of what I hear from and what I see is that people are having trouble getting in touch with their loved ones once they've been detained. It truly does feel like they're being disappeared, where they can't find them on online trackers. They can't get in touch with them. There's no kind of trail or information, and you're just kind of waiting around to see if they'll show up or, you know, call. And sometimes I recently have heard from family members in Southern California who, you know, went over a week without hearing from their loved one. And then when they heard from them, they had been transported to Texas to a detention facility there. And now they're trying to find, you know, local resources there and attorneys or visit, you know, people to do visitation there. So the needs are kind of dependent on being able to even find out information. And I think that's already a barrier. But yeah, I think there's a lot of hurt and pain and grief, of course, and there's a lot of lack of information and navigating a system that is not easy or sometimes even possible to navigate.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just horrendous. Can we talk a little bit of more about language for a second? 'Cause people have been using the term arrest, but there's also been reports of people being arrested without warrants, and of U.S. citizens being detained, like we mentioned before, and of, you know, plainclothes ICE agents just kind of disappearing people off the street. Yeah. Do these instances count as lawful arrests?
Yeah, great question. So again, technically, ICE and DHS agents should have warrants to enter spaces like homes or private businesses to be able to make arrests, but they can make arrests in public. So I guess that is something that might not always be understood by the public, that ICE doesn't need a warrant to arrest people in public. They should still be arresting someone specifically, not just like profiling, and some of that is getting hazy right now. But yeah, in terms of what is lawful, it's a little bit unclear because some of these instances are horrible, but still lawful, and some are not, but we won't kind of see the repercussions of that or be able to litigate it until way after. And at that point, the individuals harmed might already be deported or harmed enough. So some of even being able to challenge that or being able to look at these arrests and even look into whether that was lawful or whether they needed a warrant in that situation, I think they are kind of operating on knowing that they can get away with it. And some of what makes that hard is while it still is a legal system and there are rights that we all have, even someone without legal status, there aren't as many ways to have checks on those rights, if that makes sense, because the legal system, once you're in removal proceedings, once you're in detention, is very stacked against immigrants and migrants. So even if you kind of are arrested in an unlawful way, if they then show you don't have status or you don't have whatever valid status, it kind of is like, oh, doesn't matter, like, guess we shouldn't have done that, but you don't have status anyway, so you've already violated the civil immigration law. So I think that's where some of the legality of what we're seeing is hard, because it might in some cases be legal, even though it feels like it shouldn't be. And then even when it's not lawful or legal, it doesn't always feel like there's a lot of recourse, or whatever recourse there might be might come way later.
And Simone, I'm thinking about connections between violence that is carried out by the United States here and violence elsewhere. For example, there has historically been solidarity, I'm thinking of, between Black, Hispanics, and Asian communities in the United States with Palestinians. In one of our previous shows, Dr. Elise Semirjian explained how Gaza is now a testing ground for weapons and technology that will be exported to the rest of the world. But at the same time, we do not have to look far away to understand what is happening today. The U.S. is, after all, a settler colony with historical and present-day violence, such as indigenous genocide, enduring systems of enslavement and incarceration, and the Japanese-American internment, to just name a few. I don't want to minimize the escalated violence that we are seeing today. Without doing that, can you also discuss what we are missing if we frame this moment as unique in American history?
Yes, definitely. I really appreciate this question and kind of contextualizing, because I totally agree. And I wouldn't consider myself an expert in history. And I think that we really have to not look at this as unique or uniquely new or unprecedented, because a lot of what's allowing what is happening currently to happen is because it has been in the law and been possible for however the last 30 years. And then beyond that, beyond the, you know, enshrined law, it's been possible in our history because of how we've always treated the other. Of course, you mentioned Japanese internment, but other parts of history to mention are obviously Chinese exclusion, especially when we're talking about legal history and immigration system. That definitely created a basis for our immigration system to be operating on exclusion rather than inclusion, and rather than migration being seen as expected, acceptable thing, it's seen as something to limit and prevent and to deter. We also have a really horrible history of the Mexican braceros, and a lot of how this country has used migrants for labor and then disposed of them and their families when that was not convenient anymore. So yeah, both with Chinese laborers, Mexican braceros, and various other kind of like migrant labor populations, they have kind of been given temporary status to be working, and then the legal system made it so they couldn't actually gain lawful status, or even if, you know, their parents, grandparents, whoever had been here for a while. And yeah, there's a lot more if you dig into the history too on developing the definitions of who is an acceptable immigrant by lines of race and class. So definitely there's a lot of solidarity. There's a lot of history there. And I do think it's important that we keep that in mind, because what we are seeing in this moment is directly tied to that history. And, you know, to be very specific, especially with the history of like racial capitalism and labor, that's happening again now. They're proposing temporary visa permits for laborers on with farms and whatever other other similar plants without promising any immigration kind of legal pathway. So yeah.
Phew. Speaking of the interconnectedness of all of the state violence that we are seeing right now, can you talk a little bit more about so what you called crimmigration, the intersection between immigration and the criminal justice systems?
Yes, as you can tell, I'd love to, since I've already brought that up a few times. Yeah, I think part of it is that, again, our history and our current immigration legal system criminalizes migration. It's not a system of welcoming. It's a system of exclusion and criminalization. With that said, it's still immigration, for the most part, without getting into some nitty-gritty, is not a criminal violation. It's a civil violation. But a lot of the interplay between our criminal legal system and our immigration system really targets certain communities. And as I mentioned earlier, there's definitely a kind of like prison to ICE pipeline, or go even farther back, school to prison to ICE pipeline. And I see this as a community that's often left behind, and kind of even in our conversations now, which I would say more people are, you know, getting involved, more people are seeing the issues, more people are anti-ICE, and they're still kind of talking about these, saying things like, oh, and they didn't even have any criminal history, or just saying things that further these ideas that if someone did have a criminal history, then it would be okay, which is not true. And as soon as we are okay with that, we allow things to progress to exactly the point they have now, and why we have allowed.